Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Happy New Year! Chinese New Year, that is. It's the year of the goat. We begin our celebration the way they do in China with a Baijiu toast. Then, we'll visit New Orleans East for their Tet Festival. And we'll learn how to host a dim sum brunch with Gabriella Gershenson of Every Day with Rachel Ray. Break out the firecrackers. It's time to party on this week's Louisiana Eats. Have you ever tasted the Chinese liquor Baijiu? I hadn't even heard of it until I met Baijiu enthusiast and writer Derek Sandhouse, who joined me from across the world to share a couple of shots of that ancient liquor. Derek tells us about the origins of Baijiu and its recent emergence in the West.
Well, Baijiu is about a 1,000-year-old Chinese drink. China has a winemaking tradition that spans almost 7,000 to 9,000 years. And, you know, about 1,000 years ago, distillation technology arrived in China and they began making all sorts of spirits. And as that technology spread throughout China, several different types of unique spirits emerged in different parts of China. So those are collectively what we call Baijiu today. It's a category of at least a dozen distinct types of spirits that are made in the traditional Chinese way. There's four main types of Baijiu. Three of them are made with sorghum, and one of them is made with rice. And the main difference is there's strong aroma, light aroma, sauce aroma, and rice aroma. Now, the rice aroma is obviously the rice. The strong aroma is one that's made by fermenting the grains in big earthen pits over the course of about a month.
Yikes.
So it's a very labor-intensive process. The sauce aroma is made in a similar way, except it's made in brick pits. And the light aroma Baijiu is sorghum that's fermented in just clay jars. So each of those processes give them a very different character and taste.
And what does Baijiu mean to the people of China?
Baijiu is literally white liquor, but it means, you know, connection. It means getting to know people. Whenever you have a holiday meal, whenever you have a celebration like a wedding, or whenever you have a business meeting, you always have a bottle of Baijiu on the table. So people like to say you can't set the table without alcohol. So it's a really important part of Chinese socializing and the culinary tradition over there.
Well, I'd like to know, Derek, how a guy from Kansas got so wrapped up in this exotic Chinese liquor, Baijiu.
Well, I was living and working in China for a number of years, and Baijiu, for most foreigners who live in China, becomes one of those things that you're afraid of. Because whenever you do business in China, someone will crack a bottle of Baijiu at your business meeting, and the expectation is that you're going to drink the entire bottle before the meeting's over.
And what's the proof on that?
And the proof is usually about 53%, so like 106
proof. So you're in trouble.
So yeah, it's something, it's a very...
The average Westerner is in trouble.
Right. People have a very aggressive introduction to Baijiu most of the time. And, you know, I think most people would respond negatively if their first taste of whiskey was here, try this, you know, smoky scotch and drink the whole bottle before you're done. When I was getting into Baijiu, people told me that they'd done studies, that there's a flavor threshold. A point at which you go from not liking a drink to liking it. So with, you know, beer or coffee, you need 5 to 10 glasses before you say, this is a gross drink to something I enjoy drinking. And the rumor was Baijiu was so hard to like that it took 300 shots. So I started by chronicling my conversion from someone that didn't like baijiu to someone that enjoyed it by drinking 300 shots of it. And I think...
How long did that take?
I had the first shot of baijiu that I truly enjoyed around 60 to 65. And I think it had nothing to do with how much volume of baijiu I consumed. It had to do with finding the right brand. Just something that was really high quality, had a balanced flavor, and was just really easy to drink. A lot of Westerners are confused because they go into the grocery store and they just see all these different bottles, lots of Chinese characters, different price points, and they don't know where to begin. So one thing that I wanted to do was, A, to see if I could overcome my fear of baijiu, which I did rather quickly, and B, to see if I could find a way to make it accessible as a category to other people that wanted to learn about it. Because baijiu is the most widely consumed spirit in the world. Every year they produce somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 8 billion gallons of it.
So yikes! Wow. How would you describe the taste to people?
Well, it's tricky because there's so many different kinds of baijiu, but the most popular baijiu and the one that we're going to be drinking the most of today is called Strong Aroma. It's from southwestern China, and it has a very fiery, peppery taste that has some kind of powerful fruit notes. So you can get pineapple, apricot, and other tropical fruits in there.
Okay, I'm game.
Okay.
So, and then we're starting at the top, huh?
Yes. So what we're going to start with is Strong Aroma Baijiu. They have two different styles of it. The first one that we're going to have is made by Jian Nanchun, which is in Mianzhu, Sichuan. And that's made with 5 grains. So sorghum is the predominant grain, but there's also rice, glutinous rice, wheat, and corn in here. So this gives it a slightly complex flavor.
Okay. And what do you say?
You say ganbei.
Ganbei?
Yeah, ganbei. So, yeah, down the hatch.
Wow.
The what do you think?
It's fabulous. It tastes like there's something on the back palate that reminds me of eating my favorite Sichuan food.
Yeah.
I totally get it. Yum.
Yeah, it pairs this type of baijiu made in Sichuan, the strong aroma, pairs very nicely with really strong peppers. In Sichuan, they use a numb spice that kind of deadens the palate a little bit. So this wakes it right back up.
Well, that certainly does. So tell me, why is baijiu only making the trip to America now?
I think the reason for that is just that China itself is only starting to open itself up to the world. You had basically with baijiu an industry that was a complete cottage industry up until the 20th century. When the Communist Revolution happened in the late 40s, the government took over the baijiu industry and really brought it into the modern era. So the first 30 years of Mao, you had a completely closed country. Almost nothing was leaving the country. And then once China started modernizing its markets, people in China for the first time could taste baijiu that was produced at the other end of the country because it was available on the free market.
Wow.
So with baijiu, it's a very old drink, but in a certain sense, it's very new because there's not this culture of connoisseurship where you have familiarity with the baijiu from all over the country. So people in China are just starting to figure baijiu out. And as they're doing that, they're starting to look overseas. And I think there is a market for China here, particularly at Chinese restaurants, because it is such an important complement to Chinese cuisine.
Absolutely. So how long has it been available in America so far?
I think you've been able to find various baijiu's in, shady Chinatown liquor stores, for several decades. But in terms of a concerted effort to appeal to people that aren't just Chinese immigrants or businessmen, that's relatively new. And there's a lot of companies both in China that want to bring their products overseas, and there's also, distilleries in America that are looking to introduce baijiu to foreign consumers.
There are so many changes happening in China now. Are there any events that have occurred that are helping to spur this export effort?
Yes, absolutely. The biggest change is that Baijiu for several years in China has been associated with government corruption. It became associated with corruption because the government had been buying this Baijiu for their banquets. And when the price went up, people started pointing out, well, you're spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on alcohol every year. Why are you using your tax dollars in this way? So the new president of China, Xi Jinping, when he came into office, one of the first things he did was said that the government can't spend public money on Baijiu anymore.
Okay.
So a lot of these distillers who had relied as on the government to be a huge sales channel now need to attract customers in the more traditional way.
What's the strategy that Baijiu is using to take over America?
I think the two best paths to appeal to Americans with Baijiu are, one, through Chinese restaurants. For the first time in America, we're starting to see people show an interest in authentic Chinese cuisine, not just the chop suey San Francisco Chinatown Chinese food. And in the same way that you go to a Japanese restaurant and you drink sake, you go to a Turkish restaurant and have rakı, you need to be able to go to a Chinese restaurant and have baijiu, because that is how people eat in China.
Wow.
So that's the one strategy. The other is to appeal to people that are looking for new flavors in their cocktails. There's a lot of cocktail bars in China, particularly in Shanghai and Beijing, that are starting to experiment with baijiu cocktails. I think they're really leading the way. But there's also, I know, a lot of bars in California, in New York, that are starting to incorporate baijiu cocktails into their menu. Because I think for bartenders, this is a really exciting category, because it's pretty much uncharted territory.
Yeah.
It's got very strong flavors.
So it's going to hold up in a drink.
A lot of the fruity notes people find complement, rum and other sweet drinks very well. A lot of the rum and baijiu cocktails that I've had are really nice, either using rum as a complement or substituting baijiu for rum.
Very interesting. What do you see is the difference between the way Americans consume spirits and the way the Chinese consume baijiu?
The main difference is that baijiu is consumed exclusively with meals. You don't find baijiu at the karaoke bar. You don't find baijiu at the nightclubs. It's something that you only drink while the meal is being served, and it's supposed to complement the flavors in the food. They both bring out the best in each other. Whereas in America, I think most people will not drink neat hard liquor with their main courses.
Or they're going to have a cocktail before dinner.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. The idea with baijiu and with Chinese alcohol generally is respect. That when you are drinking with someone, you never drink alone. You never sip on a baijiu. You always drink it in a toast to show your respect to someone else. So, shall we try another?
Yeah. For some reason, I'm a little nervous.
Well, okay. Ganbei.
Tell me again.
Ganbei.
Ganbei.
It means dry the glass.
Okay. Well, Derek, I am so thrilled and honored that you came all this way and brought all of these remarkable discoveries and treats to us here at Louisiana Eats.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, the door's always open, so come back and see us, okay?
I'd love to. Thanks.
Baijiu enthusiast, Derek Sandhaus. When we come back from a short break, our New Year's celebration will continue Vietnamese style with the Tet Festival. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
The Vietnamese celebration of the Lunar New Year has been celebrated in New Orleans since 1976. Many Vietnamese came to New Orleans following the 1975 fall of Saigon because our subtropical climate, along with close proximity to fertile fishing grounds and waterways, reminded them of home. Since 2001, Mai Win's restaurant, Ba Mien, has been an active part of the Tet celebration, a three-day party that included over 20,000 attendees last year. We've come to New Orleans East to visit with Mai at her restaurant, Ba Mien, and she's welcoming us in the reception hall next door. Mai, thank you so much for talking with us today.
And I thank you and welcome to Ba Mien.
How did you first come to love cooking?
As you know, because I'm the oldest family, the oldest girls in the family. I have 11 brothers and sisters in family, big family. So I've been helping my parents cook a lot. And I always like to learn when I go out to eat. You know, if something different come up, I always try to go home and try to cook it.
Tell us, how do you participate in the Tet celebration?
First, we have a private celebration with families. And in my community, on that weekend, we always have a festival with the community. Working at the restaurant, I help some of the groups prepare or order and stuff to help them prepare the food.
With all the busyness, describe the celebration for me. What's going on out here during the festival?
Yeah, well, we always attend the midnight mass to thank God for the wonderful years that we have. And most of us stay up to midnight to welcome the new year with fireworks. And then the next day, we go visit each other. And we wish each other, you know, all the lucky, happy, longevity, and wealth, everything for the new year.
When did you first come to New Orleans?
November 17, 1975.
My goodness, you even know the exact date. And how old were you then?
I was 14 when I left Vietnam.
Do you have any early memories of Tet in Vietnam?
Yes, I do. I still remember that when I was young, I have to go here, like in American Christmas, you bring gift for the elders over there. Vietnam, I during that time, I did that already. I know I have to go miles, carry the present for the grandparents. And first day of Tet, we go around to our elder people to wish them all the good things for the new year.
Are there traditional dishes that are served only for Tet?
Yes. I have a very, very good experience because in my family, for the past 20 years, every Tet, like a month before Tet, we all are helping my mom to prepare the sticky rice that we actually make the sticky rice and sell to the community. And inside they have meat and mung beans wrapped with banana leaf, and they cook for many hours. But this year, we feel bad because this is the first year my mom doesn't do too good, so she's not making that. So that's something that we're really missing.
Another Louisiana tie that I understand we share are kumquats and mandarin oranges, which of course we call satsumas. Mm-hmm. So those are part of the traditional Tet celebration. How are they used?
Yeah, we use that as for the decoration, and we picking that for the Thanksgiving. We bring all the harvest that we have, so all the tree that have a lot of fruit, we think that's bringing a lot of luck. So, you know, that's why many families have that.
That's wonderful. Well, in the meantime, everyone can drive out Chef Mentor to New Orleans East and visit you here at Ba Mien for an authentic Vietnamese experience. Thank you so much for welcoming us here today, and I want to wish you a happy new year.
Yes, chúc mừng năm mới.
Thank you, Mai, and we'll be back to see you soon.
Thank you.
Mai Nguyen of Ba Mien Restaurant in New Orleans East. Goat is one of the most widely consumed meats in the world, but it's just catching on as the other red meat here in the United States. Some people say it tastes like lamb, sort of how bison compares to beef. It's also an environmentally sound alternative to factory-raised proteins. Goats have a low impact on pasture land. They maintain grasses almost like lawnmowers and eat things that we don't eat, like poison ivy, thistles, nettles, and burdock. They're like candy to a goat. According to the USDA, goat is lower in cholesterol and fat than beef, pork, and chicken. Use it ground in spaghetti sauce or cubed in stews. But my favorite cut of goat are the chops. I season them lightly with salt and pepper, brown them on both sides, just like a pork or veal chop, then deglaze the pan for a little gravy and serve them with rice or mashed potatoes. Yum! Make a New Year's resolution to give goat a try. After all, it is the year of the goat. To learn about the Tet Festival at Mary Queen of Vietnam in New Orleans East, we turn to food writer Ian McNulty for details on their annual three-day event.
Poppy, if you love Vietnamese food and you love neighborhood festivals in New Orleans, you're going to love the way that Tet comes off in New Orleans East. This is out, of course, in Village de l'Est, the longtime Vietnamese enclave out in the far eastern part of our city, where you think, am I still in New Orleans? Yes, you certainly are, but it does feel like a different community after you've driven that length. And I should say, you know, this one that we're talking about here is one of several Tet celebrations that are held around the community, but this is definitely the big one. This is at the Mary Queen of Vietnam Church, and this is the one that just draws people in really from all over the region. It's huge. You're driving along Chef Mentor, and, you know, it starts to look pretty ex-urban, let's say. One of the signposts up ahead is when you see the gigantic Folgers plant emerge. You know, Michoud Rocket Facility is near here. These are some pretty iconic destinations for eastern New Orleans. If you're coming to this area during Tet Weekend, do not worry. All roads lead to the Mary Queen of Vietnam Church where they hold this thing. The church itself is a big compound campus, really, and it's teeming with people all weekend long. And this draws in thousands of people, like I say, from all over the region. And the reason that I love the Tet celebration there is because it really gives you a feel for this Vietnamese community that's blossomed in New Orleans. All over the city and the suburbs, we've seen so many Vietnamese restaurants come up. People are reinterpreting it. New generation of Vietnamese chefs and restaurant owners are presenting their own view on the cuisine. It's a really exciting time for people who love this type of food or just want to explore it. But if you want to get to the roots of it, this is a fantastic opportunity because you're seeing the Vietnamese community celebrate with themselves, with their own community. For people who are interested in eating, you are all set here.
Sometimes when I go to these community festivals, someplace that I'm not usually a member of, I feel a little bit like an outsider, you know, and I'm always kind of insecure about, do I have to buy tickets to get the food or what's the procedure for eating?
It's a very welcoming community, Poppy. You walk into the gates, and it's, of course, a very family-friendly event. It's happening on church grounds. And what you'll find are, I'll say, Jazz Fest-sized tents. And some will be filled with retail goods. Some will be filled with food. Plenty of them will be serving drinks, beer. Some of it's carnival food, but a lot of it, of course, is Vietnamese food prepared in different areas at different tables by different groups who volunteer and organize themselves to do this. So it's not like you're having one place for pho, the beef and rice noodle soup, but many of them. You could possibly sample different pho around the same grounds going from tent to tent. Banh mi, of course, are big. Fried bananas seem to be the go-to dessert. Batter fried, yellow, delicious, right out of the bubbling oil. You can watch your individual banana be fried right before you eat it. Fun atmosphere. Big, long tables everywhere. You'll see whole families sort of camped down at one, other people moving around. Lots of Heineken. That seems to be the brand of the day for sure out
Isn't
there.
Isn't that interesting?
And kids running around helter-skelter everywhere. Of course, on stage, there's traditional Vietnamese folk music, Vietnamese pop music, beauty pageants. It's a lot more than food, of course. But, you know, the way that some people, myself included, look at the world, it's food first. And I definitely come out there to eat. Another big part of it, of course, we talked about the food, talked about the music. Lots of games of chance out there.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Some that I wasn't familiar with either. You know, you walk up to a table and everybody is very, very avidly watching the roll of a dice or a cup moving around the table. So you can take your chances, too. It all supports the church, of course.
And what do you win?
Well, you could win cash.
Ooh, okay.
Always the best part. But you're not voting on jacks and aces and kings and queens. You're gambling on whether something will land on a shrimp or a chicken figure or just different ways of separating very generous contributors to the church from their money.
Well,
possibly rewarding a few.
It all comes back to food, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. This is not a place to expect to line up, get one tray of food, eat, and be done with it. The best way to do Tet celebration from a food point of view is to come in, try a few things, go watch one of the bands performing, go check out the gambling tents, work your way back through the food tents, have a Heineken along the way, and try some more food. Like I said earlier, different types of the same dishes prepared by different people, often a very different profile.
Well, I'm putting my money on the lucky shrimp. How about you?
Shrimp has never steered me wrong, and I'm willing to give it a chance.
Well, let me be the very first to wish you a very happy Tet, Ian McNulty.
Well, thank you very much, Poppy. Same to you and all that follow.
Louisiana Eats rambling reporter, Ian McNulty. If you can't make it out to New Orleans East for this year's Tet celebration, then perhaps you can find comfort at the bottom of a warm bowl of pho. Food writer Scott Gold sent us an ode to his favorite Southeast Asian dish.
My brother Eric loves pho. Actually, it's not really love. Love is more natural and harmonic. This could more appropriately be described as an obsession, a psychological tic that tells him if he doesn't get some of that hot Vietnamese noodle soup in him on a regular basis, his internal organs will shut down and cerebrospinal fluid will begin leaking from his ears, followed by a dramatic and painful death. It's serious. Over the past couple of years, Eric has been on a one-man personal campaign to sample the pho at every Vietnamese restaurant in the greater New Orleans area. His go-to is always pho thai, which incorporates rare steak, usually from the beef flank, though every now and again he'll switch things up and go with pho nam, brisket. As the steaming bowl is set in front of him, the ritual begins. Add a squeeze of lime, bean sprouts, sliced jalapenos and basil leaves, then squirt in enough sriracha sauce to turn the broth a vibrant orange. Then commences the eating, which Eric does with practiced, studied movements. Each slurp of broth, bite of beef, and mouthful of noodles accomplished with contemplative, almost robotic precision. By the end of the bowl, which he tilts to his face to ensure not a drop of soup escapes him, my brother is finally satisfied, even though his face is crimson and pouring sweat as though he's been pacified by the kind of mace they use on grizzly bears. He is a red, sweaty mess, grinning ear to ear like a maniac. When it comes to Asian noodle soups, my first and true love has always been Japanese ramen. Not that pho isn't perfectly lovely, but the heart wants what the heart wants. And, of course, my heart is in my belly. Recently, however, my opinion of pho has begun to change. It might be Eric's subtle influence, but more likely, it's the fact that I have discovered pho ga, a rich chicken broth with rice noodles, chicken, and onions. Essentially, pho gà is Vietnamese chicken noodle soup, something special to me and to pretty much anyone who's ever been home from school sick as a child, preferably watching The Price is Right. Chicken noodle is the penicillin of soups, restorative, comforting, and essential. It is a magical bowl of soup, perfect for just about any occasion. Cold out? Pho gà will warm you. Hot out? Spicing up your pho gà will make you sweat and thus cool you down. Bad day at work? Pho gà, of course. Excellent day at work? Celebrate with pho gà. Hungover? Better get some pho gà in you stat. Lord, I'm starting to sound like my brother.
Scott Gold is a food writer in New Orleans. His Food Porn Fridays column is available each week through nolavie.com. What foods are always part of the traditional Chinese New Year celebration? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What foods are always part of the traditional Chinese New Year celebration? The most important one is fish. The Chinese word for fish is yu. It sounds just like their word for surplus, also yu. So the Chinese believe that eating fish as part of the New Year celebration guarantees a surplus of money and luck in the new year. Rice cakes, spring rolls, and especially dumplings are also part of the feasting. Chinese dumplings are said to resemble silver ingots, so eating them will bring more money and wealth in the new year. And by the way, red is the lucky New Year color, so gifts of money are exchanged in red envelopes. Bring on the money. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. The January-February issue of Every Day with Rachel Ray features a do-it-yourself dim sum party. Every other recipe for Chinese dumplings that I've seen requires specialty equipment like a bamboo steamer and a wok. Amazingly, those clever folks at Every Day with Rachel Ray figured out a way to make traditional pot stickers using just one piece of equipment already found in most home kitchens, a non-stick frying pan. Here's senior editor Gabriella Gershenson with the how-to instructions.
It's shockingly simple. For starters, you need to make your filling. And it's fun because the filling is really where you can go in for variation. So my personal favorite is an edamame and shiitake filling. So it's the frozen edamame soybeans that you can get at the grocery store with shiitake mushrooms. And it's just so, so flavorful. And it happens to be vegetarian, too, which is delicious. And then when it comes to making the dumplings, you buy wonton wrappers at the grocery store, which I'm pretty sure just in the refrigerator section where you would find tofu, for instance. So it's like if you've ever made ravioli, it's a similar concept. You put this round piece of dough in the palm of your hand, and you scoop in just maybe 2 teaspoons of whichever filling you've made. So after you've done that, you fold the wrapper in half, so that it goes from a full circle to a semicircle, and you pinch around the edges just to make sure that your filling doesn't spill out. And then you place that little half moon in your hand, and you create pleats. That's basically it. And then you set it down on a floured surface and just, you know, repeat until you have as many dumplings as you like or you use up all your filling.
Now, how in the world do you cook them?
Well, for starters, we're just using a little bit of oil, so you're not running into that potentially explosive situation where you're deep frying and then get a little bit of water in the oil and then have to run for cover because the pot's about to explode. You start with a large nonstick skillet and heat up just 2 tablespoons of oil, and then you place your dumplings in the pan. And you just fry it until it's golden, and then that's when you add 1/3 cup of water and quickly cover the skillet and just reduce the heat, and that just helps it cook a little bit, and the water cooks down, and the dumplings start to fry up again. So it's kind of an interesting hybrid, and it's a method I've actually never seen before, but I was very lucky to taste the results. And what you end up getting is that nice, tender dumpling with a fabulous, fabulous base that is just crispy and bubbly and brown.
There's a lot of hands-on work in prepping those little dumplings, so make your dim sum party a kitchen event. Your guests will have so much fun helping with the assembly and then will be as amazed as me with that one-pan cooking trick. Leftover uncooked dumplings can be frozen for later use. Send the cooked ones home with your guests, preferably in takeout Chinese food containers, available in a wide array of colors in party stores everywhere. I like those Chinese food containers so much, I'm often tempted to use one as a purse. You can find the shiitake edamame dumpling recipe on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com and wwno.org. Most people think of bitters when they hear the name Angostura. What most people don't know is that the company is also a major rum producer. Different from other rum companies, theirs is barrel-aged. Angostura sells more rum than any other brand in their native Trinidad and Tobago. 4 of their rums are also available in the United States: a 5-year-old rum, a 7-year-old rum, and 2 legacy rums. The company's master distiller, John Georges, is at Angostura's helm. I'm here with John to learn all about what sets Angostura rum apart.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the Angostura history.
Oh, Angostura is an old company. We have been in existence since 1824. We started off in Venezuela, and in 1875 or thereabouts, we came to Trinidad, and we've been there ever since.
What was the motivation to go from Venezuela to Trinidad?
Well, even now, Venezuela is a difficult place to live, and it was not any easier back in 1875. So the family moved from Venezuela to Trinidad because Trinidad just presented a much more business-friendly environment. And not only that, their iconic Angostura bitters was also selling very well in Trinidad, which at the time was a British colony.
I'm so fascinated. I'm ashamed, actually, to tell you the truth, that you all are such an old and esteemed company, and I really only knew about the bitters. Is there very much Angostura rum distribution in the United States?
Well, we've only just begun, really, to be serious about getting beyond the diaspora. In other words, there are a lot of Trinidadians in the New York area, in the sort of New Jersey area, probably out west as well, and they will have the Trinidad and Tobago rums that they brought from Trinidad with them. But we have this special range of rums that we created to try to reach a wider audience.
What makes Angostura rum so special?
Well, from my point of view, it's everything. Everything makes us special. From using our own yeast for the fermentation, carrying out the fermentation, following our own special protocols, distilling so that we produce the spirits just so. And as a distiller, I think that's the important part. But then aging and blending play a big part. That's how we manage to achieve the variety of spirits that we have. We have aging warehouses with over 65,000 casks aging with spirits of different quality. And when the blenders come together, they can make really good magic.
Well, let's start at the beginning. How do you make rum in the first place?
Oh, Making rum is easy, Tasco. You need a source of sugar to ferment, and that source of sugar must be sugar cane. It cannot be anything else.
Yes.
And then you need to ferment it. And the yeast that you use to ferment it is important. And then after fermenting, you distill. You distill to release the alcohol that has been made during the fermentation. Now, it's not just alcohol that's made during fermentation. Of course, it's alcohol, but then there are so-called congeners, certain elements that are made alongside the alcohol that are really responsible for the aroma and the flavor of rum.
Tell me that word again.
Congeners.
Congeners.
Yeah.
I never heard that word before.
Oh, that's everything. That's everything. Everything. That's why when you do the distilling, you've got to have some talent. Because having the right level of congeners and the right type of congeners is what will give your rum the right flavor and the right aroma.
Well, what are those things?
Typically, I don't know, maybe you know a little bit about wine, and they will speak about esters and aldehydes, these aromatic sort of things that have sort of flowery or fruity notes. And then, of course, you've got some of the other notes that come from the barrel. Because having made the spirit, to really bring the best out in the spirit, you need to age it. And we age it in once-used bourbon barrels.
How interesting.
And the aging in the barrel now gives you something else. It gives you vanilla notes, it gives you chocolate notes, it gives you maybe some tobacco or leathery notes, depending. And between the two of them, when you age your rum together, you've got the fruity notes from the rum and the other notes from the barrel, well wedded. It's an amazing, amazing product.
One more question about the ingredients. Is all the sugar grown in Trinidad?
A little sore point with me. Unfortunately, we do not grow sugar in Trinidad anymore.
There must have been in the beginning,
Yeah, we had lots of sugar. And when I started in Angostura, all our molasses came from Trinidad. But now we're getting all molasses from the Dominican Republic, from Mexico.
What happened to the sugarcane industry in Trinidad?
The oil business.
The oil business, yeah. That's what happened to the Louisiana wetlands, too.
And B, also, it's just money. There's no money in sugar, really.
Right.
It's a difficult business to be in. Right. But I tell you, the rum business, sugar is basically made the same wherever. So when we import molasses from wherever, we're making our rum. It's Trinidad rum.
It becomes
Trinidad rum
is.
The moment we use our yeast, the moment we distill it, the moment we age and blend it.
What are they blending exactly, John?
Right, no. I spoke about the rums and the congeners. Well, when you make your rums, you make rums, basic spirits with different levels of congeners, some that are very aromatic and very powerful, and some that are light, and some that are in the middle. And you age these components. And when you age these components, you end up with very beautiful spirits. They have a good look. They've smoothened out, they've rounded out, and you just, in order to get consistency and to create different styles of spirit, you blend them in different proportions and mixing rums of perhaps of different ages, sometimes of the same age or the same quality, just like a master chef would put together a recipe. And everything that a chef is concerned about, we're concerned about. We're concerned about how it looks. We're concerned about how it smells. We're concerned about how it tastes, and we're even concerned about how it feels. So all of these things are taken into consideration by our blenders using their techniques. And blending is a little bit like cooking again, another analogy. You don't just chuck everything in a pot and hope it works.
No.
There's a recipe, there's a process, and there is a method.
I'd like to go back to the subject of aging.
Mm.
How long do you age these rums for? You all are such an old, old company. what do you have hidden and tucked up in the warehouses on Trinidad?
No, aging rum is, again, it's another bit of a mystery. You've got the oak barrel. They grow the trees, take the best lumber they can find, and they form it into the barrels, and they char the barrels on the inside, and they're aiming for consistency, but they know no two barrels are identical. No two barrels are identical.
No two trees identical.
No two trees are identical. So when they make these barrels, some of them just produce better rums than others, and it's oak. Spirits just work best in oak barrels, and I don't know what it is, like peanut butter and jelly. Who knew that they would really come together so well? Spirits and oak, macaroni and cheese. They just were made for each other. So when you age in the barrel, a number of different things happen. First of all, the spirits continue to develop. Spirits are almost living. The material in them continue to react. It's a little bit like, and my driver coming in was telling me this works with gumbo as well. Gumbo on the first day is fine, but gumbo on the second is even better.
You're talking to the gumbo girl, and that's absolutely the truth.
Same thing with rum. Mm. Fresh rum is fine, but when you age it for a while, it just gets better. Of course, it takes more than a day in for rum to get better. It takes years. And then the barrel components. As I mentioned, the barrel adds vanilla notes. It adds chocolate notes. It adds leathery notes to the spirit. It just oozes from the barrel. And quite a bit of the color also comes from the barrel.
So how long does the spirit age in the barrel?
Varies. If we put a rum in a barrel, it'll be in there for at least 2 years. We really don't have a maximum. But in the Caribbean, you know, when it comes to aging, and only rum, not people, the spirits develop quite well, quite quickly. And so that you don't really have to be in there for very long for the spirit to really get some stuff from the barrel and to start to really develop and get those aromas and flavors that you get to like and taste.
Do the barrels get reused?
We reuse our barrels, particularly for the lighter rums. We reuse them if we know we have a lighter rum. Not a lot's going to happen. And we're focusing on the development of the spirit rather than, you know, the input from the barrel. So it depends on what you're after. If you want the input from the barrel, then you want a new barrel so that you get a lot of the stuff coming in. But if you're more concerned about the development of the spirit itself, the barrel is just somewhere to hold the spirit while it's maturing, while it's getting a little rounder, a little more mellow. The work of the barrel is quite stunning. It transforms the spirit.
So the aging finishes in the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
Then the blenders come in and work their magic.
And they get their recipes and they bring it together and they work their magic and ta-da!
And then it goes into the bottle.
Ta-da!
Does it age further in the bottle?
No. Typically, you would think that aging will not really happen in a bottle for a couple of reasons. One is oxygen is such a key part of the aging process, and when you put it in the bottle, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then when you've done your blending and so on and it's all over, the spirits that you have selected, you'll put them through a finishing process. You filter them and settle them down. And the spirits are very unlikely to develop significantly beyond that point, beyond putting them into the barrel. And that makes you feel good.
Well, I can't tell you how grateful I am that you made the time taking a trip all the way from Trinidad to come and talk with us here on Louisiana Eats. So thank you, John.
No, my pleasure entirely.
Okay, you're welcome back anytime.
I hope I get to come back. I definitely hope I get to come back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Master Distiller John Georges of Angostura. Celebrate the Lunar New Year with a tiki drink that uses Angostura as a base. Mai Tais, zombies, and hurricanes will certainly liven up any party. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, metal artist Thomas Mann with the scoop on being a contestant on the Food Network's new show, All Star Academy. So you get the gig. When do they finally tell you you're on?
Basically about a week before I'm supposed to go. And I asked them the question. I said, well, how many people can rearrange their lives in such short notice to be able to make a gig like this? And they said, well, you either want to do it or you know.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickie Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to our production team,
Thomas Walsh, Joe Schreiner, and Chris Kehoe. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.